The following podcast contains language that is not suitable for everybody.
Man, I need to go to the gym right now.
Welcome to Super Skull Vault of Midnight's weekly new comic day audio digest. My name is Cool Nick Wybar, and I work at Vault of Midnight. I'm joined by Huggy Bear Schwimmer.
You want a hug right now?
Yes, I do.
I'm a little warm, and you're so cool.
And Thunderlip Sullivan.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. What does that mean? Why did you make that sound?
It's like a wrestling noise. Thunderlips is like my wrestling name.
Oh, I see. Is that a reference to an actual wrestler?
That's a fake wrestler. His name's Bonesaw.
Okay.
He's in the Spider-Man movie.
Uh-huh.
He's played by a very famous wrestler.
And Thunderlips, your fake wrestler, is an homage to another fake wrestler.
From the Rocky movie played by Hulk Hogan.
It's all coming
together. So much stuff. So much stuff.
More importantly, we're also joined by our very special guest today, Charlie Bronson Tucker.
Yeah. Well, hello.
How
That's
are
a great
you?
Nickname. I've never had that before.
That's pretty good.
You've never had Charlie Bronson Tucker as a
I
nickname?
I haven't. That's... I always get the same ones. Charlie the Unicorn, Charlie Bit My Finger. This one is brand new, though, and I'm really appreciative of that.
Charlie Bronson Tucker is, I can't believe, I thought, of course, you'd be like, oh, yeah, people have been calling me that for years.
Yeah, that seems like that's like low-hanging fruit.
Sounds like a gunslinger.
I just haven't been hanging out with the right people, I think.
Do you know what my other nickname for you was?
What was that?
Chuck Norris Tucker.
Oh, big fan of that one.
That's pretty good.
Because we also call you Chuck sometimes.
Yeah.
And you're just a badass ass kicker who shoots a lot of people in the face, so.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Charlie, thanks for hanging out with us today. It's always really cool when you're on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
What's going on out in Grand Rapids? What's up with your world out there?
Well, we are just grow business. Grand Rapids is just doing tons of cool stuff. We're getting ready to, like, get into the summertime, and so there's tons of people coming down. For like Grand Rapids just has a bunch of outdoor festivals and cool things going on. Lady Fest is starting in April. That's one of my favorite things. It's like a one-day festival all about women in the community, and that's really cool. Then we have Grand Rapids Zine Fest, which is in the summer. So it's just like the best time of the year right now.
You sound like a representative from the city of Grand Rapids
yeah.
right
it's
now.
It's so cool.
Grand
I'm
Rapids
so glad
is
to be up
so
here.
Cool. Do you have like a bunch of entitled college professors who like to come into your store and educate you on stuff? Because that's what we got in Ann Arbor.
Are you dissing on Ann Arbor right
yeah,
now?
Oh my I am God. A little like, bit.
Jesus.
Yeah. Well, you hear about all the cool stuff that's going on in Grand Rapids. You know, you get a little jealous. I'm a little jealous.
We get some like, no, I don't even want to say this sounds mean, but we get some like, some art students maybe that think they're too cool for comics. But they're usually like pretty open to it when they come in. So we get to get a lot of art students reading comics.
They're ready to be won over.
That's
you just
right.
Need, you just
yeah.
need to crack that veneer a little bit.
That's right. Turn on the Charlie Bronson charm. And
yeah, you just got to get a little silly with them. And they start to giggle, and then everybody relaxes.
That's
if you can
thing.
Make an art student giggle,
bang.
You've done your job.
Go home and take a nap.
you've earned it. Have a Miller High Life and a nap. I have a million-dollar idea.
Tell me.
Then I'm ready for you guys. I want to see if you guys want to invest.
Oh, fuck. Here we go.
Charlie, are you in on this? I don't want you to miss out on this really exciting money-making opportunity.
Sounds like a pyramid scheme.
Okay, so you guys are familiar with Where's Waldo?
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is Chris Where's Waldo.
Okay.
But instead of finding a tall man
mm-hmm.
in a striped French shirt.
You're looking for a father figure.
You're looking for a man who just like realized what kind of man his father is.
Yeah.
For the first time. Or like a woman who just never, who has realized she has just actually been disappointed for the first time ever in her life and never knew what disappointment was. And that instant is on her face and you have to find her in the mass of other sad people.
Well, it sounds hilarious. Where's the money part come in?
So this is why I'm really excited to talk to you guys today.
Yeah?
Because I think I can get this off the ground for probably not less than $45,000 to $55,000.
Because
it's going to be...
That's the initial seed money.
Exactly.
You'll need subsequent injections
of
cash.
Yeah, Mr. Ware's efforts will be volunteered.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
I would imagine.
Yep.
But, you know, it's a lot of full color. It's a big... It's like, you know, there's a lot that goes into the production of this.
Well...
I see.
If I could just give an idea.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I'm not really looking for notes right now, but yeah, go ahead,
I'm
please.
I'm just saying, you get the concept.
Uh-huh.
I will contact our friends at DHgate, and we'll get it made for $3.75.
Ah, so we just do the whole thing on the super illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah, we farm it out to...
Mm-hmm. to my good friend.
Yeah.
At the warehouse in, you know, the east coast of China.
Can we get...
We're friends. He tells me in every email.
Can we get a... who's the best Chris Ware knockoff that you guys can think of?
Oh, I can think of one. Chris Ware knockoff?
Yeah. Because we... And let's be honest. Chris Ware is not
going to be expensive.
He's not going to be down. This is about... I'm trying to make money with this. I'm not trying to, like, make an artistic statement. I'm trying to make money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I need somebody who's also down to make money.
Who's new and fresh. Isn't quite in the industry yet.
Yeah. Well,
maybe it's a deviant art. Like, we find a young artist with skills that we can just... Yeah. Low ball. You
know, and I can't stress this enough. It has to be Chris Ware's Waldo.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to use his name.
I see.
So a lot of the money is also retainer fees for
the inevitable lawsuit.
Yeah, because this dude is, like, super litigious.
We could get our favorite Tracer artist and get him to do it.
Who dat?
Oh, you know.
You want Gregory Land?
I want Greg Land. We pay Greg Land to just trace Chris Ware.
Greg Land.
Yeah, because he's a tracer anyways. He
now
has no
you're talking.
He's cheap. He's
so
got to be
he'll just
cheap.
Lightbox previous
yep.
Chris Ware
yep.
works.
Yep.
Cut and paste.
Oh, this is pretty good.
Greg Land. He's the key to the whole thing. And that dude's been sued so many times.
Yeah.
He's a champ at it now.
Yeah, he doesn't even care.
He's got the legal system down.
He's got a flock of lawyers on just standby.
I think Greg Land's the ticket to the whole thing.
You have to find a dude who realizes that the physical shape that he's in is the physical shape he'll be in for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
I love this, the deep, deep sadness to all your words.
I'm just saying. So I have a note here for Daredevil Season 2 is amazing.
It's so good.
Is that true?
It's really good.
It's really good.
I'm in it. So last night I started this. I went to work. I wasn't feeling so hot when I got home. Mm-hmm. I had a little bit of a headache, so I started to watch Daredevil Season 2.
Oh, Huggy Bear, you had a headache?
I did, yeah.
Oh.
But man, oh man, it is phenomenal. It's so good.
So there's a fake biker gang in Season 2. They're called the Dogs of Hell.
Yeah.
It's like the best fake biker gang name I've ever heard.
Their biker lounge is what I imagine co-owner of Vault of Midnight Steve Fodali's secret basement looks like.
Oh, if we ever have like money,
yeah.
like that will be the employee executive lounge. We'll look just like the Dogs of Hell.
Like a biker lounge?
Playhouse.
Oh, so cool.
For guaranteed.
It was the best. I am just so very impressed by what they're doing with Daredevil. In this Netflix series. And the Punisher in it is just the Punisher that I've always wanted to see on the screen.
So you guys
can
remember?
I say I'm a little hot and cold on the Punisher, though. What? I'm only like 3 episodes in, so I don't know. But
what makes you cold?
I don't want to spoilers here, but he's a lot more maybe extreme even than I thought he was going to be.
He's a one-man dynamite stick of justice.
This is the thing when you take comic book characters and like see them in a real context, like sometimes they're fucking crazy and horrifying.
Yeah.
He's a murderer, and you can tell that he stinks. That's how much of a vicious killer he is.
Yeah, like he hasn't showered.
Yeah, you can smell him through the TV.
Yeah.
It's
but
scary.
It seems like he is like willing to like let, I don't know, it seems like he's willing to let maybe some innocent people get in the way.
Hell yes.
And
look.
Is that, I don't know, I feel like, that was so intense to me.
Sometimes you gotta.
Oh, go.
You gotta,
oh, boy. go ahead.
I'm just saying, sometimes there's gotta be some casualties for the greater good.
Wow. And he said it.
Look, yeah.
I see what side of the line we're both ending up
on. Yeah. Charlie Tucker and I are gonna fight on a rooftop in rain now.
To the death, and maybe some kids will get killed. Like, but,
well, hopefully,
you know.
Hopefully they're not children.
Oh my goodness. There's a lot of Foggy in this new season of Daredevil.
Nick,
we all cool with that?
Nick, I like Foggy.
I love Foggy Nelson.
I'm coming around to Foggy this season.
I am
like
coming
before,
around the other end where I don't like him. It's like too much Foggy.
Oh, all right.
He cares so much. He's got so much heart, Foggy.
Speaking of the Dogs of Hell, he just like the whole time he was like, please, I'm so sorry. Please stop hitting me.
Yeah, because
he didn't get hit once, Foggy. Relax.
He's terrified. He's in a bar owned by the Dogs of Hell.
Yeah, he's a real soft batch.
Yeah, he's like a Columbia law grad. Like, you know, it's not his cup of tea, but he's doing
it
for the people.
Did you hear that great speech he gave in the hospital?
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Like, all he does is drop speeches. Real speech maker.
I always like it when like he drops the speech and it'll just be like everybody in the background, you can just see their face. Their face is like, damn. because Foggy's just laying it out.
He's an artist. Pretty good. He's an artist of words.
I
was at a convention this past weekend, and there were a couple Foggy cosplays.
What?
And they were all similar in that they all had like the worst wig ever.
Were they all wearing diapers?
A terrible head of hair.
A bad wig and a lot of perspiration is what you need for the perfect Foggy cosplay.
Wow.
Well, that's enough for the Daredevil. What's up in the news, you guys?
Oh, well, let's see. What do we got? We got some DC Rebirth, kind of.
Still?
Yeah.
Is that still a thing?
Still a thing.
That
it's
hasn't
gonna
even
be a
happened
huge
yet.
Thing. It hasn't even happened. We have barely begun to talk about it. I'm just going to plug the DC Previews book that's going to be coming to comic stores around the world. It's a 96-page full-color catalog, essentially, of all the Rebirth stuff from DC.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be free at your local comic book store.
And DC Rebirth, just one more time, what is that? What is DC Rebirth?
So they're going to relaunch. All their series are ending,
mm-hmm.
except for stuff that's outside of main DC. So there are Scooby-Doo books, their TV show books, their Vertigo stuff. All that stuff continues like normal. But all their kind of core DC universe stuff, your Batmans, your Robins, your everything else is getting rebooted. There's going to be special issues called Rebirth. It'll be Robin, Rebirth, Superman, Rebirth, right? And then we're going to get into all these new ongoing series.
Cool.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking about, you know, I hope we get to see them actually born. Like, I hope we get to see them all, like, leaving a birth canal of some kind.
Robin's got
metaphorically.
We don't know.
Or otherwise. Yeah.
Does Robin come from an egg?
Maybe.
Is there, like, a giant egg he hatches out of?
We don't know.
Because I would like that. I just, whenever I hear about DC one-shots right now, I just fear that they're going to end up next to all of the Convergence one-shots. But I'm trying to stay optimistic. I'm trying to really, like, come in with an open mind.
Me also.
We just have so much Convergence left in the shop still.
So dig this. This book comes out on April 13, you guys.
Oh, mm-hmm. soon.
It's going to be a giant, like 100-page cool full-color catalog. I'm legitimately psyched for it. Hopefully we'll have some great creative team lineups. Marguerite Bennett is rumored to be writing Wonder Woman.
That's cool.
That's very cool.
What else did Marguerite Bennett work on?
She's working on DC Bombshells right now. Charlie, is that right?
Yeah. She also has done some A-Force, I think.
Oh, you're yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's qualified, so that could be cool.
She's writing the new Red Sonja, too, I think, which I kind of like.
It is pretty good. The new Red Sonja is surprisingly good, yeah.
Dig it.
Yeah, hopefully what we're going to get is a whole bunch of really awesome creators, reinvigorating the DC universe.
Yeah.
Find out all about it on April 13.
Yep. It's a special time. The quadrennial rebooting of a publisher.
Yeah. Every 4 or 5 years.
It fills me with anticipation and excitement for what cool stuff they could come up with every single time.
It does. And in my mind, right, we just came off a really cool, I think, relaunch. I think we can all agree. The Marvel All New, All Different, despite its goofball name, has been just excellent.
Yeah. And it was pretty soft. It was a pretty soft reboot.
Yeah.
But I'm into it.
Yep.
Good stuff came out of it.
Yeah. So, and also check your internet on Friday. DC is going to make some big announcements at WonderCon.
Oh, cool.
This Friday.
Ooh.
About the Rebirth event.
Well, DC also announced this last week that they're coming out with a new animated movie. We announced last week that they're talking about doing a Killing Joke film, but they also are coming out with a Justice League versus Teen Titans animated film. And I've been catching up on the DC animated film universe over the last couple weeks.
Yes.
And I just finished Flashpoint Paradox, and it was phenomenal. So I am very excited about this Justice League Teen Titan animated film. It looks really good. Anything with the Teen Titans.
Agreed.
When we were diving in last week and about Marv Wolfman a little bit and about his connection to the Teen Titans, it just got me really pumped about it, and I'm super excited about this. Justice League members essentially get zombified in some way or taken over mind control, and the Teen Titans have to fight their Justice League counterparts, which sounds pretty cool.
Dope. So, they're mentors.
They're mentors,
if you will.
Interesting.
Cool.
Very cool. Any Detroit news?
Detroit news, what do we got? I mean, it's basically done at this point.
Well, we hung out on Friday and we talked to a whole lot of people about maybe working at the comic shop.
That's right, we did do that.
We did interviews with a bunch of people over the course of like 5 or 6 hours.
It was bonkers.
Or something like that. And it was an amazing crop of folks. I am so excited to get into Detroit, you guys.
Agreed.
It was really, really cool.
Yeah, we the candidates that we interviewed.
Oh my God.
It's going to be hard to pick.
It's going to be so hard to pick.
It's an embarrassment of riches, if you will.
Feeling really good.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling very good.
Nothing gets Nick more excited than the prospect of training 5 brand new people.
Qualified applicants.
love qualified applicants.
So we were also at Cantillon Finishers production facility yesterday.
Yeah, these are the dudes making like our shelves and our counter and all that stuff.
Yes, Nick described it as a Willy Wonka's factory of comic shop building.
Yeah, but with a lot more cigarette smoke and swear words.
Yeah, and coffee.
It's really my ideal Willy Wonka factory, if you think about it.
Oh, it was crazy. There was like a dozen people there, and they're sanding and gluing and building and painting. And
it didn't seem right. It was like, what are all these people doing here, Jove? Why do you have so many people here right now? Like, oh, they're all working on your comic shop.
Yeah, shelves everywhere. It was awesome. We got to test out the new graphic novel shelf and lay comics and graphic novels on it and make sure how it all fits and how it looks.
I slept on it.
Check the angles.
You couldn't fit on that shelf.
It was wonderful.
It was great. We picked all the final colors, you dudes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is what you live for, Curtis. You live for this shit.
It's wonderful. And it's now right now it's starting to coalesce into a thing, right?
Yep.
It's a million stupid ideas that we talk about for months and months, and then it all starts to narrow and narrow, and we're almost there at a done design.
Yep. A Swedish pharmacy on the moon is almost on the moon.
With cocaine. Yep.
With cocaine.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we spent all the money on the comic store, which we have dubbed, well, Nick dubbed, the world's most expensive comic book store.
I'm just saying, I think it might be.
So we have no money for Cho Chain now.
We have no money for any cocaine.
Yes. So.
Well, this is not how I wanted to find out about that. But
sorry.
I quit.
Fantastic.
Charlie, we spent the cocaine budget. I'm sorry.
I'll just run everything for you guys. Don't worry.
Thanks, pal.
Thanks, buddy. What do you guys think? You want to do some big picks?
Let's do it.
In the apple orchard of comics, we're helping you pick the not rotten apples. I was really struggling this week. I start thinking about it like 5 minutes out, and I reached down and there was nothing there.
Sometimes you nail it.
Provide the golden Macintosh of the week.
That was okay. So, what this actually is a bumper crop of comic books are released every single week, and we each pick something that's our favorite. And I'm just going to play host this week. I don't even have a favorite. I love all of my children equally.
Okay.
Don't make me choose. But what I would like to know, Curtis.
Yes.
Thunderlips Sullivan. What was your pick this week?
My big pick of the week was the Bloodshot Annual 2016.
How was it?
It was wonderful. Let me tell you all about Bloodshot.
Please.
He's like a kick-ass dude who is a killing machine.
Mm-hmm.
He's filled with billions of nanites.
Yes.
And so essentially he's indestructible as long as he can eat some protein. So he gets shot in the face, eat some protein.
Have a boneless, skinless chicken breast.
That's right. Arm ripped off, eat a bunch of broccoli?
No.
I think that's fiber. I think you're thinking about fiber.
No, keep naming other things that definitely don't have any protein in them.
He specifically needs protein.
He has to eat
I'm
a notebook.
Yeah, there's a lot of protein in wood glue, I've heard. Anyways, moving on. This guy's awesome. He just kills at will, and he essentially worked for this organization called Project Rising Spirit, and he was just a gun that they used and wiped his mind every time he got done.
Yeah, so it's, hey, Bloodshot, wake up. Wake up, buddy. Wake up.
Yeah.
Are you sleepy?
Mm-hmm.
We need you to go kill these four dudes.
Uh-huh.
They kidnapped your family.
Yes.
And if once you're done with this mission, then you're out of the game forever.
Yeah, and they're pretty insidious about it. They would make up, fake family memories.
Yes.
To even further
and
mess with
it. And implant it in his brain. And then he would go and kill all of those people and be like, okay, where's my family at? I'm ready for this to be over, my final job. And
mind
like,
wipe.
All right,
back
cool,
to sleep.
Bloodshot, come on back. And then they would wipe his mind and put him back to bed.
Yes. So he's this issue finds some short stories with Bloodshot out into the field. There's a great story. The opening story is The Slasher of Silver Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a goofball twist. Like, what if Jason Voorhees of the Friday the 13th movie franchise was a failed nanite killing machine? It's awesome.
It was really good.
It had feelings.
Jeff Lemire wrote it.
The art is really, really nice.
And Jeff Lemire
normally writes it, right?
Yeah, he's writing the normal regular run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that guy's a good writer. The Silver Lake Slasher story has art by a guy named Kano. One word. One name. He's like the prince of this Bloodshot episode.
Excellent. He's like the Madonna of this episode.
There you go. The art's really great. There's killing. Bloodshot gets his leg torn off. It was awesome as hell.
Bloodshot should be stupid
mm-hmm.
and is very much not. all of these dudes are so aware of like the roots of Bloodshot
yeah.
and how potentially stupid it could be, like if you just take it as a pitch.
Yeah.
Like he's got a weird rising sun, like Japanese flag. He carries a suit like on his chest.
Yeah.
Right? He carries a samurai sword around. He is a product of the 90s.
He wears no shirt.
He wears no shirt at, yeah. At any time.
No, doesn't matter.
And his whole thing is just murder.
Yeah.
And these dudes, and from the beginning, from the kind of the Valiant relaunch of this character, they have figured out a way to make it like a commentary on dumb action movies and dumb action comics in a way that's, it just works so well.
Yeah, and then they also do that nice thing where like there's a sadness to the character and a kind of a weird poignancy to
yeah.
Bloodshot. But really for me, guys, the reason that I was so juiced.
Yeah, I was a Benjamin Mara.
About this issue. Is Benjamin Mara does the last story in this comic.
This is like the perfect artist for Bloodshot.
It's so cool. So this like weird cult decides that the nanite blood of Bloodshot is going to open a portal to this like nether dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And they will get to go and be like these dark gods. The name of the story is Hell Cloud Awaits. And all these people are trying to get to the Hell Cloud. But yeah, they open the portal with his blood. All these demons come through. There's just tons of killing. And it's got this great Ben Mara art. Yeah, he kills demons in this, y'all.
Ben Mara of?
Terror Assaulter.
Yeah.
Marcus's favorite book of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
By far.
Yes, of the upcoming collection, American Blood.
Charlie, I don't know if we ever got your take on Terror Assaulter, if we ever talked about it.
I'm all for Terror Assaulter.
Damn it, Chuck!
Immediately.
God.
It's the best. I read two pages and that comic was sold.
Did you?
And this Bloodshot annual was like just what I could have hoped for. There was a dude that was like a super swole buff guy, but his head was like the torso of a really curvy lady.
Yeah. With like so energy awesome. Beams for her arms.
Yeah.
Energy sword arms.
So good.
No, he's great. Everything he does is great.
Yeah. One of the demons is a giant floating red skull with like huge demon teeth and then like muscular arms like on the side of the skull, and he just floats around and he's like talking shit about Bloodshot the whole time. Like, why do we need this idiot? Super funny.
Yeah, Bloodshot, Reborn. I think you could just go into this cold.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I don't think, if you just want to read a fun, stupid, smart comic.
Yeah, there was four short stories in this. They were all great.
Mm-hmm.
There's a goofy like middle story where it's like essentially like the owners of Valiant Comics being like, we're idiots. We've got to appease, you know.
Oh, we gotta keep Jeff Lemire happy, or else he won't write Matt Kent's books for him anymore.
Yeah, super funny. They killed it. This is a great, big old fat 64-page book.
Yep,
I enjoyed the fudge out of it.
Excellent. Thank you for your pick and your service.
You are welcome.
Hey, Charlie.
Hey.
What's your pick this week?
My pick is actually something that came out last week, but so excited about it, I had to bring it into this week's episode. It's a book called Goodnight Poon Poon. It's a manga by one of my favorite manga writers named Inio Asano. This is a manga that came out in 2006 or 2007, I want to say, and is finally now getting released in English by Viz.
I had no idea it came out that long ago.
Yeah, it's been around for a while. This guy's been writing books. I mean, he's definitely one of the more like modern manga writers, but generally, you know, it takes a while for these things to get licensed into English, and
sure.
Now we're finally seeing it. But
what else has he done?
His big one is a book called Solanin.
Yes.
It's kind of like a coming-of-age story about being in your 20s. And then recently he did Nijigahara Holograph, and then Girl on the Shore just got released, too, about a couple months ago. So
and those
he's
are
got a pretty good
all in English,
work.
Charlie?
Yeah, all licensed now in English.
Oh,
so.
Cool.
But, yeah, this is a – it was a – probably done in like several volumes, and Viz is collecting it in two-in-one. So technically this is just a first volume. I think if you wanted to, you could definitely just read it as a standalone though. It's about a boy, his name is Poon Poon, and he's like a, you know, your basic average, just Japanese boy, and just about like him growing up. He's depicted as this kind of crude drawing of like a little bird while everyone else around him is just like a normal person. And he also you never get to hear him speak at all. It's always done in like these kind of thought bubbles,
mm-hmm.
and his way of speaking is kind of portrayed through how everyone else is just talking to him. yeah, it's just about this kid and his life, and it's really sad. Definitely about kind of the emotional toll that things take on you as when you're a child and how they kind of create who you are as an adult. It starts out with Poon Poon as like a third grader, and it progresses to middle school and then high school years, and eventually ends with him in his 20s. And yeah, a lot of his stuff, Inyo Asano's stuff, is very sad. He's kind of like, I would compare him to someone like Chris Ware, very melancholy, kind of an emotional trip to get through, but it's definitely worth it. And his art is just the best.
I love it. What can you tell me about that cover on this book, Charlie?
Oh, yeah. Is this, I got a great, is it him as a bird?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Poon Poon. The whole series, he's pretty much depicted as this little, like, you know, childish drawn bird. And there's not, it's, the whole book is up for interpretation. You can't really say why he chose to draw him as this bird while everyone else is like a beautifully drawn human. But I think it's more so you can kind of get like sort of this outsider's perspective on him. And he's kind of like wearing this mask. So you have, you know, you don't get a general sense of like how he's going to be like feeling all the time. So you kind of have to like really try hard to work and see like where his emotions are, I think.
Yeah, this seems to be like, this is how he sees himself, as kind of like, he's much smaller than everyone. Mm-hmm. He's not just like different, he's like a different species from everybody else around him. Go ahead.
As he starts to progress, there are like small changes, or like, you know, he'll do something bad and he'll have like little devil horns or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this book. I thought this was so good. Really, really good. Like he has crushes on girls in his class. He wants to watch porn. He's a member of the Porn Watchers Club that he and his friends formed.
Nice.
He's having problems at home.
Yeah, they're always trying to say like, oh, I got some hardcore porn. We're going to watch this together. And nobody actually really has anything.
Yeah, it always fails. Yeah.
That's hysterical.
He's having like, his family also is all, they're all represented like this. Right, Chuck?
As birds?
Yep.
As this kind of like bird creature. Yeah, his uncle and his parents, and something really serious happens at home. We won't spoil it. But it's all kind of, you get the sense that everything that's going on with him is a direct reaction of these really horrible things that are happening to him at home.
Yeah.
We're just kind of like seeing the fallout. This is why he feels it the way that he is visually represented. It seems like.
That's so funny.
It's not funny
at all. No, about the, I'm sorry. It's very funny about the porn club.
Yeah.
It's giving me a flashback. Not that I was in a porn club. But
it's a good mix of like finding like those little tidbits of like, you know, childhood that everyone can relate to. But then it also, I think, does a good job of sort of stepping back and exposing like, hey, this is, you know, how events can in your childhood can really affect you as a person as you grow. Because as the story progresses and he gets older, it just kind of takes off from there. And you see how, like, you know, as kind of a depressed little boy, that just continues into an adult in his 20s.
Yeah.
Well, the way you guys are describing it, it's making me think about how crucial stuff can be, even though it's not, you know, you get some years and it's not as bad. But when you're in your late teens, early 20s, you know, things, minor events.
Well, it's a good mix of that because some of it are very major events.
I see.
Some of them are like really intense house stuff that will follow you your whole life.
Right.
And then some of it is just the most trivial things that you can imagine. But you're totally right. Like when you're a kid, all of that just gets mixed together into what you can handle and what you can't handle. And
well, everything's the biggest deal when you're 16.
Yeah, really, except maybe the stuff that really should be a big deal isn't as big a deal as it,
right.
You know.
And it's just, it's really masterfully done. The art, you touched on it briefly, Chuck, but the people are, it's so beautifully drawn.
It's really unique to his style, too. It's not like any other manga. And his backgrounds, too. He does a lot of like realism in his backgrounds to make everything look like it's like he kind of uses actual photos of stuff as well.
Yeah.
And
it's gorgeous.
So it makes everything around him seem very real. But then you have this one small cartoonish little bird as the main character.
Mm-hmm.
Nick was flipping me through this book this morning. This dude's cityscapes are just breathtaking. I mean, he is a master of the cityscape for sure.
And it makes him, it makes Poon Poon more striking because everybody else is so like meticulously drawn.
Right.
The faces are so beautifully rendered, and he's so like simple and crude. And you get these like, you zoom in on Poon Poon's face, and you just see like the line drawings and the effects of like the ink.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't get more detailed. You just see how crude it actually is, just closer to wow. him in the frame. Yeah, I thought this was just, this book was a knockout.
Charlie,
yeah, it really makes you feel like that character you can see because he's so singular, like he's kind of in his own head, in his own world, mm-hmm. different from everybody else.
Charlie, did you read Princess Jellyfish this week too?
Oh, I've been reading Princess Jellyfish. It's awesome.
So I asked Ann Arbor manga buyer Christian, there were a couple number ones that came out this week for manga, mm-hmm. and I said, Christian, which one should I read? And he was like, well, you should absolutely read Princess Jellyfish.
Charlie, what's Princess Jellyfish about?
Princess Jellyfish is about a group of women that move into an apartment in Tokyo, and it's kind of an apartment for otaku women, which is essentially like nerd girls.
Yes.
They're all into really weird things. Like one girl's super obsessed with trains, and someone else is like very into like ornate Japanese dolls, and they all have these really weird quirks. And it's just kind of about their life. There's someone living amongst them who's like cross-dressing male, and only one of them kind of knows his true identity, and she's trying to keep it from everybody else. Meanwhile, this whole apartment complex is under the threat of being demolished for like renovation of like new structures and stuff like that. But it's kind of slice of life, but it's got that like everything is like kind of hyperbole in manga, I feel like.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It has the very relatable story of like, I look like this, everyone else looks better than me, and that's how I view the world. Like, no matter what I do to myself, either I need to not care about this aspect at all, or I need to strive to look like these other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it just masterfully. It's really great. And it's full of, it's got a lot of serious subject matter in it, but it's just speckled with these little moments of humor on how these girls perceive one another and how they look. Like a lot of them, you never see their faces because their big hair covers it, or their hands are always in front of their face. And it was not what I thought it was going to be at all. But I powerhoused the whole thing last night.
You thought it was going to be about a jellyfish?
Well, it just, the cover is not, it doesn't feed you the idea that there's this whole story about a cross-dressing male and mm-hmm. what's going on with his life. Why is he dressing like this? Why is this central to the story? But it was phenomenal. I really enjoyed it. There's some connection between this particular young lady is obsessed with jellyfish because there's a connection to her mother and her backstory, and it really makes you think like, what are the things, the odd things that you connect to your own family that maybe no one else gives a shit about, but because you have this one memory with a parent or a sibling, that thing is very important to you. I thought it was great. I think the social dynamics in this book are super interesting. The idea of living with a bunch of nerdy dudes in a dude compound, it would be a totally different book than this, and I think it would be an interesting contrast. It'd be very funny. But, yeah, it was a great book.
Well, you had me at trains.
You don't see, like, that character, like, the characterization for women often, and it's cool to see, like, you know, they're just a group of nerds either way, you know, so it's like, you know, they happen to be women, but it's cool to see that. You usually get like the nerd guy, I feel like, in a lot of comics and graphic novels, and it's cool to see like women with like quirky and like particular interests all just living together.
Yeah, and they have like the Oracle who lives in their apartment complex, which is, you know, they slip messages under her door because she never comes out of her room, and then she sends these like very funny dramatic messages back. And that's kind of how these girls make their big decisions, is this person that they've never really met, they just slide paper under her door, and she gives them these ultimatums like, no boys or death. And they just trust the system.
Interesting.
And that's how it's set up. It's very interesting.
If you guys wanted to work a similar system out with me, I'd be willing to do that.
You just want
to
live
just
in...
Just send me your problems, mm-hmm. and I through under my door.
But in a physical form. Not,
yeah.
We can't just email you? Or...
No.
Okay.
Write it down.
Yep. All right.
Send it over to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm ready for this.
You're ready for that task?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great book. I really liked it. It is unlike any manga I've read before, and I really enjoyed it. Not that I've read a ton, but...
And if anyone wants a taste of it, I believe that the anime, which is really good, I think that it's still on Netflix.
Oh, really?
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I'm going to dive into it.
Chuck, is there anything else that you are excited to read this week or that you read and that you dug?
I started reading another manga called Real Account. It's sort of like a battle royale mixed with sort of Sword Art Online, kind of one of those classic, like, you're trapped in a video game and everybody's going to die unless you do this thing.
Classic.
It's all right. I think it's going to be really, really good for people that are fans of stuff like Sword Art Online or maybe kind of that darker social commentary type stuff like Death Note.
Cool.
So I think that I think it could be a hit. We'll see.
I like all those things. You just sold me on it.
Thank you, Charlie. Your pick was Goodnight Poon Poon. I wholeheartedly second that. It was really, really cool.
Can I designate some of my time to Charlie real quick?
You can.
Because we got her.
We got her.
She's an expert. Charlie, you know, we just talked about manga that's come out in the last week. Like, if there were two or three titles that have come out in the last 2 or 3 months that you think are just real big hits in the manga world, what would they be?
I would say first, everyone should check out the re-releases of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. They are, Viz is collecting them in hardcovers since the very beginning. And it's essentially just a bunch of story arcs about this kind of crazy family with people with weird superpowers. It's like sort of kind of like Dragon Ball Z or One Punch Man, that very like extreme action, real buff guys. It's really cool. So that would be a big pick. I've also really been digging on Food Wars,
yeah,
which is a cooking manga.
Yeah, the covers of this manga make me so hungry.
I know. And the cool thing is they actually go into detail. It's, you know, these kids at a cooking academy, and they're competing to be top of the class. And it actually goes into detail on kind of how to make these dishes.
Ooh.
And, like, what ingredients you need and what the theories are between why this stuff works. So, yeah, I want to start maybe like a blog or something where I go in and I try and make every single dish that they create, and I probably will fail at all of them, but I might learn a lot.
But then it's like a reaction video of after you make the food, like whoever eats it, they just start crying uncontrollably or all their clothes explode off.
Yeah, they start eating the books and they'll, like, you know, angels will descend from heaven and like greet them with these wonderful dishes, and they just start crying and weeping tears of joy.
Yes.
It's awesome.
Excellent.
Cool.
It's great.
Marcus?
Yeah.
With the remainder of your time.
I know. I'm going to keep it short and sweet.
Please hit me with it. Short and sweet.
I wanted to give Charlie as much time as possible. She's such a fountain of wisdom. G.I. Joe Deviations is my big pick for the week. Mm. Sometimes I don't know how to describe my sense of humor because often we just, you know, it's like that Prairie Home Companion. But I do have a funny bone. It's not maybe as big as other people's, but I do.
You know what is something that is naturally found in all funny people is when they refer to their funny bone.
Thank you.
That's like a universally yep. found thing.
I have a
Prairie
funny
home
bone.
Marcus.
Yep. And G.I. Joe Deviations hits my funny bone in the funny spot. It's written by Paul Aller. He writes a ton of TMNT spinoffs. That's like his main thing. He did a Turtles in Time run that was really great.
Excellent.
And Nick, he also wrote Tet from IDW, which you and I really dug.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A little shoot off about the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. And it's drawn by Corey Lewis, who is not super well known in the industry, but has a book coming out in April called Sun Bakery from Press Gang.
Mm-hmm. And it's awesome.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a little short story collection that's coming out every week. I'm very excited for it. This dude's art is killer. But essentially, this book is Cobra Commander has won. He's defeated the Joes.
Cobra, the ruthless terrorist yep. organization, hell-bent on world domination.
Has achieved world domination.
Got it.
That was very good.
That dude?
Yeah. And so now Cobra Commander's just so bored. He wants to, you know, incite destruction and chaos, but he rules the world, so he's only hurting himself when he does these things. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially they're having these staff, the book starts out, they're having a staff meeting and they're like, you know, I need an update on this thing. And they're like,
hatches a cockamamie super plan.
Yeah. He's like, I want to destroy all telecommunications in the world. And they're like, that's a really bad idea, Cobra Commander. Like, we rule the world.
He wants to put lasers on every eye of every statue in the planet. And it's weaponize all fish in the ocean.
It is the funniest book. It's just, and he's so bored. And Cobra Commander just has to ensue chaos, even if it's against himself.
He's just got to be Cobra Commander.
He's got to be true to himself. This book was very, very funny. I was in stitches while I was reading it, and I just absolutely love it. These little deviation books that IDW is doing have been a real hoot so far.
So good. I agree. With
They've been really, really great.
Deviations just means like it's just like Elseworlds.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, essentially, because like, it's like, aren't you just deviating constantly?
It's just like that's pretty good. Yeah, it's just very to the point. This is a deviation.
A slight deviation.
Pardon the deviation.
So, yeah, that's my big pick. I read some other stuff this week though.
Hit me with it real quick.
Yeah, Hyperion, number one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First of all, I love a superhero named Hyperion.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Second of all, he's a truck driver who just tours America.
Wait, you read this book?
Oh, yeah.
You liked it?
I loved it.
Oh, I thought it was hot garbage.
Did you really?
Oh, I thought it was just a mess.
Oh, I thought it was so fun and like pulpy, cheeky bullshit. I dug it.
I knew immediately the first page that Marcus was going to like it. It's got Hyperion, like just getting out of a truck.
Yeah, it was awesome. And he just like...
Looking like an American guy.
he's red, white, and blue flannel all the way. I thought it was... It didn't take itself too seriously, which I really dug. It's just like a light, goofy, pulp superhero. Like, he wears a giant radioactive symbol around his dick. Right?
I love his costume,
yeah,
dude.
So like inherently, he's a kind of a goofball character. But
well, he's from the Squadron Supreme,
yeah,
and they're all sort of like just ripoffs of like the Justice League archetype stuff. Yeah,
I thought it was very fun. It was light. It was pulpy. This girl like knows that he's Hyperion, even though he won't admit it, and she's like sought him out, and so she's trying to bait him a little bit throughout the whole book, and then finally she's like, "I know who you are," and he comes out. And it's like this big, overly dramatic. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I don't think it's garbage to be garbage. I think it's garbage because he's a pulpy character.
Oh, I think they're totally unaware.
Oh, I don't think so.
I think they have no self-awareness.
I disagree
about it.
I
think they're
disagree.
Playing it straight.
No. And then Totally Awesome Hulk is totally awesome as always. The book only gets better and better. Worst X-Men Ever number 2 came out this week.
How does it hold up?
It's great.
I loved the first one.
I think this series is going to be a book series that I will recommend and trade paperback for as long as it's available. It is wonderfully goofball. And I must talk about my biggest disappointment of the week. I know we don't spend time on books we don't like.
We'll breeze right by it.
But I was just so excited for Independence Day number one.
It was really stupid.
From Titan Comics. I was so pumped. It's definitely my cover of the week still. I love the cover.
Because of the red, white, and blue.
It's an American flag with a giant alien spaceship. But it just was such a hot pile of garbage.
So it's Independence Day in a submarine.
Yep.
It's the submarine versus the spaceships, but underwater.
Yeah, it's really bad. And what really lost me is there's like a sexy lady scientist, mm-hmm. and they did the classic undressing scene, like, "Oh, I caught you undressing," and then she's just like, "Don't make mistakes." It's just garbage.
But
it's
like
filth.
So it's they send this scientist underwater.
Yep.
And he has, guess what his greatest fear in the world is?
Tell me.
It's being underwater. It's big bodies of water. So the whole time that he's fighting aliens, he's like, "Also, I'm very stressed out right now about all the water. I just want to make that clear."
It's so bad. The only redeeming factor of this book is if you are a fan of Independence Day like myself. In the back, they have like a little timetable for what's been going on between the last movie and the new movie that's coming out.
Oh, this comic will bridge the gap between the two movie films.
For all of the unanswered questions about the Independence Day universe.
They ever talk about how lame it was that they hacked that laptop and used that to defeat the aliens in the first movie?
No, Independence Day is one of my favorite movies. So. Okay.
Oh man, I love that they're just like, we have an Independence Day lore.
Yeah.
We have like, we're doing world building from fucking Independence Day.
Some of it's very interesting. Like they talk about,
boy.
There's some of the aliens from the crashed spaceships land in the Congo and the United States and other nations have to engage in guerrilla warfare with them in Africa.
In the Congo, no less.
I'm going to stop you.
sounds great. I'm very excited.
All right. Well, thank you for your pick, Marcus. That was your actual pick was G.I. Joe Deviations.
Yep.
Is that the title?
Correct.
Yes. Which is a one shot.
Yep. Mark Curtis, your pick was Bloodshot Reborn, the annual 2016, yes. And Charlie's was Goodnight Poon Poon. And I don't have a pick because nobody's bigger than the game.
Nick, what are
I'm
you?
Here I'm here for you.
Are you excited for anything this week?
I'm excited for so many things, but we don't even have time to talk about it because it's time to talk about manga.
All right.
Okay, let's dive into... So our taser this week is manga, which is a massive, massive topic. And maybe it was foolhardy. Some would say that it couldn't be done to cover the entirety of the manga industry in 20 minutes.
600 years of...
Whatever.
Fine Japanese culture and art.
Yeah, so let's let's all these people that say we can't do it, I think we finally need to prove them wrong.
Let's do it. I'm ready.
And obviously, so Charlie reads more manga than all of us put together.
Absolutely.
Charlie, could you just get us going? What is manga?
Yeah, so manga is a word which can basically be translated to mean comics or cartooning. The kanji, there's two kanji that make up the word that basically mean like whimsical and pictures.
I love
it's
that.
It's kind of a term that's used to refer to not in Japanese, not just like comic books, but also cartooning or animation. Whereas typically in outside of Japanese speaking countries, like in the Americas, people think of manga specifically as like a Japanese version of comics. Manga is kind of read and loved by all ages, printed in black and white, usually serialized in these large manga magazines, but can be printed also in these kind of bigger volumes like the ones that we see in America today. And yeah, generally, here it's used as a term for just essentially the Japanese comic books.
Excellent. I think there's some kind of fundamental differences in vibe and feel between American comics and manga.
I would agree with you.
You guys think that's fair to say?
Yes.
Totally.
Scott McCloud's written about this a little bit. There's actually a really great YouTube series from this guy called Nerdwriter.
Okay.
Who does he did a thing on Ghost in the Shell, which is about anime, but in there he has this kind of section about the differences in approach to, you know, animation, Japanese animation, and you know, so the idea is that American comics for the most part are action to action. We're going to call it action to action. You wind up for the punch and then you follow through and you punch Hitler in the face.
Nice.
And he falls over.
Hitler's a jerk.
And that takes us a couple, three panels or whatever, which, according to this argument, like, this is goal-oriented movement. Like, there's a thing that has to be accomplished, and the art is in service towards that specific goal of that moment.
Okay.
Which makes sense for a culture that's, like, focused on goal-oriented stories and characters.
Absolutely.
These are just different approaches, maybe, in American comics, right?
To storytelling, period.
Exactly.
And definitely comics.
And what we find in Japanese comics and in Japanese animation is aspect-to-aspect transitions. So the time between panels is abandoned for the sake of exploring like space and mood, right? So instead of like taking a punch and winding up and then we see the consequence of the punch, we get instead see all of the... It's just a series of seemingly unconnected, disconnected panels that give us a sense of the mood of what's happening in that moment. Does that make sense?
It does.
I think so, this kind of can go back. We were talking about Inio Asano, and you were saying he does like these kind of cityscapes. And like, I see that a lot in manga. You see like flashes of small things. Like, you know, they'll focus on like somebody's expression or something in the house or like a butterfly flying in the sky or something, for example. And I tend to find it much more almost like cinematic sometimes than reading American comics.
Yes. So in Goodnight Poon Poon is a perfect example. We have a panel of Poon Poon like standing on the sidewalk, and then a picture of their mailbox, and then a close-up picture of a television, and then a far-out shot of their home. And this just gives us a sense of, like, it's dusk, it's Poon Poon's house, they all live here, there's a TV on. We get a sense of, like, what kind of family it is. We get a sense of, like, aesthetically what the place is like.
Yeah.
And this is very, and that's a whole page. It is just that the approach is very different than American comics. And I think it's becoming less true for American comics.
Agreed.
I think more and more artists are doing more kind of aspect to aspect stuff. You can like see like kind of vibe building. I think of who did the art for Pretty Deadly? Help me out.
Emma Rios.
Emma Rios does, I think, she does a lot of action to action stuff, but she also does aspect to aspect work in a really interesting way.
Who's the gentleman who does non-player?
Nate Simpson.
He is wonderful at this.
Totally.
He's really good at it.
Yeah.
You can see the influence.
And this is not to say that one is better than the other, but they are different approaches. And if you're ever reading manga and it feels different and you can't quite put your finger on why, this might have something to do with it because the way that the story unfolds is just a lot different.
Yeah.
And it
lends to pacing a little bit,
yes,
too, which can be a problem when people kind of transition into manga. And I think that's plays a huge role in it.
And we're going to link to the show notes this video Nick is talking about Ghost in the Shell. I cannot recommend enough that everyone watches it. I sent it out on my Facebook last night. I went down the rabbit hole on this guy's videos, but this Ghost in the Shell, like, summarize so many things about manga and anime that I've always been trying to put into words.
Yeah.
This dude does it masterfully.
Yeah, the guy's name is Nerdwriter.
Yeah, he's
great. His YouTube series. It's awesome.
So you're saying go down the manhole on this.
Absolutely.
Go down the manhole.
Yeah. Got it.
So manga's really interesting in that there's a lot of debate about like the origins of where manga comes from. And there's kind of two schools of thought. One is that manga has been happening in Japanese culture for a long time. And the other one is that it's inherently a product of post-World War II Japan. So the people who believe that it stems from something before World War II, look at these scrolls that pop up around the 12th century that show very linear storytelling and that read from the right to left, which is kind of a signature thing for us Westerners in manga. It's the number one question we get about in the shop is like, why are these books backwards? Well, they're not backwards. They're steeped in a 600-year-old tradition of reading and storytelling. But these scrolls mostly come from Buddhist temples, and they were telling stories about morality and folklore. And we're going to see that as kind of a theme in these early forms of Japanese storytelling. And there are two scrolls in particular, and I have to apologize beforehand, because I am the whitest person on the planet,
mm-hmm.
my pronunciation of these Japanese names and scrolls, I'm going to say, is probably going to be terrible.
Even your pronunciation of the word pronunciation
is
was rough.
Right, yeah. Exactly. I can barely speak English, so me slaughtering this Japanese, I just have to apologize.
General apology on behalf of all of us.
Yeah, so sorry. But there's one called Shugugiga. And it's commonly called in English the Scrolls of Frolicking Animals and Humans. And it's a 12th century scroll, and it's often referred to as the very first manga. And there's another one called Shiginshan Enji, and it happens around the same time, and that's about a miracle. It's like one of the first big storytellings about something that is not believable. It's a superhero-like attribute that a person has. And we don't really know which one came first, and there's a lot of debate about which one is the first manga. But really, when we really get into like what is the actual essence of manga, it's Yukio-e style art, which is these wood blocks that formed when the merchant class really emerges in Japan. And these merchants can afford art, but they can't afford original pieces. They're wealthy, but they're not wealthy enough for custom art for their home.
So this is like
making prints.
Mass production.
Mass. Yes.
Yeah.
But what happens that's really interesting is there's a transformation from one block print that just is a piece on your wall to they take three or four or five of these blocks and put them together and start to print them, and it tells a story. And what that does is it creates panel work
mm-hmm.
because these are individual blocks of wood set next
aha.
to each other.
Each block is a panel.
Each block is its own panel. And we get kind of the essence of manga coming out of this. And it's interesting. The Yukio-e prints are kind of the origin of manga. And then there's also this subsect of that style of art called Shunga, which is Japanese erotic prints.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very popular as well. And these are seen as the origins of hentai, which is the erotic version of manga. But the two start at the same time and kind of run past close to one another to this day.
So this is the very early predecessors. But there's another school of thought that it's all post-World War II.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yep.
Talk to us about that a
little bit. Yeah, and one of the co-founders of Studio Ghibli is a big proponent of this. The idea is that after the war in World War II, America comes in, GIs are all over Japan for a while, and they start bringing American comic books and culture with them. The Japanese are kind of iffy about their own culture at the moment. There's a national crisis identity crisis, because so much of their past is seen as bad by the GIs and what the Allies impose on what culture can be printed and what can't.
And we're talking like 1945.
Yep, 1945 to 1952 is kind of this occupation time period.
Yeah.
But what happens is when the Japanese go into their constitution in 1947 and kind of reform it, Article 21 is super important, and it says that there's no censorship. Japanese are free to print whatever they like. The government's not going to get in their way. And this opens up kind of the first big wave of modern manga. And you can't talk about this wave without talking about Astro Boy, which comes out in 1951. Astro Boy happens, and it is the first real big manga sensation in Japan. And it goes, you know, the artist of Astro Boy goes to print over 150,000 pages of manga. It's the first animated series that is put on television that is Japanese made. And the creator of this, Osamu
Tezuka.
Thank you so much. Is often referred to as the Walt Disney of Japan. He's the animation godfather of Japan. And this goes until, and the next big development, the last development I want to talk to happens in the early 50s. And there's this group called the Year 24 Group. And it's a group of women who get together and kind of break the industry and allow women to come into it. And they create this subsect of manga, which Charlie's going to talk about, which is specifically for girls. Mm-hmm. And the big person in this is Moto Hagio. And she has been working in the industry nonstop, still producing manga since 1969. And she kind of paves the way for female artists and sets the tone for female manga. But that's me wrapping up 600 years of Japanese art history in 4 minutes. But there is this, the thing to take away is this definitive argument about pre-World War II to post-World War II origins for manga. But it was really fascinating to go into. I encourage anyone to look into the origins of it.
What we should also point out is that this stuff is coming out in magazine format.
Absolutely.
So it's magazines that are released, and they're compilations of lots of different manga stories that
anthology style
that will be serialized over a really long time.
Yeah.
That is how manga was, and it still is delivered. Right? In that way today.
Absolutely.
Although we'll get into this later, that that model is maybe not as successful as it once was. But it's important to think about how are people reading this stuff. They're often reading it in magazines that has a bunch of different manga stories kind of included in there.
Absolutely.
So, hey, Marcus, really quick, my takeaway from what you just said is that the American GIs bringing American comics kind of influencing early Japanese manga.
Yeah.
And now, full circle, like we were talking earlier, the massive influence that Japanese manga is having back again on American comics.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's so cool.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So there's lots of different types of manga, and this is not about genre, but it's about who the books are kind of aimed at. And they, Charlie, you looked into this a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah, this whole post-World War II that Marcus was talking about really kind of solidified these different types of demographics that started out with manga back in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And I just like to throw out there, while a lot of these different demographics that I want to talk about are referring to people by age and gender, as we continue to grow and manga diversified, obviously those lines are becoming a lot more blurred and things are becoming more inclusive of many different ages and genders and people. But typically manga is spread into a couple of different demographics. The first one, the biggest one I think that most people are aware of, is shonen. And this came directly out of that World War II era, and they were producing these comics mostly for young boys, shonen meaning few years, and typically for people, boys ages 15, 10 to 18, I would say, somewhere in there. These are typically more action adventure, and they have male protagonists. Some big names that people are probably familiar with would be Naruto or Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z. Those are going to be like your shonen titles. We're starting to see a little bit more shonen that do feature female protagonists as well. I think a really good current example of that would be something like Soul Eater, where you also have kind of equal male and female counterparts. And I would say, like, if you were to kind of have to put like an American equivalent to that we would have for like shonen comic books, would be kind of a lot of people's take on Spider-Man, is this sort of young teenage boy going on adventures.
Cool.
We also have shoujo, which Marcus touched on a little earlier, and this is typically meaning for young girls between ages of 10 and 18. This has been around, obviously, since, the 1900s, but didn't pick up until the 50s or 60s after, I think, shonen comics for boys started to solidify. They started making these comics for girls as well. These are typically female protagonists, but they often do have male leads as well, and the male leads tend to be kind of the, quote, pretty boy types, or there's a lot of shoujo books about gay male leads as well. These tend to focus not so much on action adventure, although they can have some of that in there, but they do mainly focus on kind of relationships, friendships, and romance. a lot of people might be familiar with, like Sailor Moon or Cardcaptor Sakura. These are examples of well-known shoujo manga. And if I, again, I had to say sort of kind of an American comic equivalent, maybe something like Lumberjanes, which is kind of focusing on that age demographic, where it does have adventure, but it mostly kind of focuses on the relationships between these girls. I also kind of think that the current Archie run with Mark Waid could almost qualify as a shoujo.
I think Archie in general you could call shoujo.
Yeah. I love it.
If
yeah.
you had to.
I've never, till just now, thought of an American equivalent to of a lot of these. It's really cool in my mind to try to do that at this moment.
The next one would be seinen. This is for older males, typically late teens and 20s. These tend to be a little bit more dark, violent, psychological. People might be familiar with Akira or Ghost in the Shell. Those would be your seinen comics. Or, you know, if I were to say, like, in American comics, maybe something like Southern Bastards or even Saga.
Sure.
Kind of on the counter side of that, you have Josei comics, which basically means woman or womanhood. And this is the target audience, obviously, for adult women. These didn't actually start appearing until the late 1980s, until there was more of a demand for it. Women were reading shoujo comics and basically said, like, hey, we want something a little bit more adult. These kind of deal with more interpersonal relationships, romance, and have much more adult themes to them. Examples would be just like this Princess Jellyfish that we were talking about earlier is one of my favorite Josei comics, actually. And I would say something equivalent would be something like Rat Queens, where you have a group of women that, you know, you have your action part of it, but mostly they're kind of dealing with their relationship lives and romance, and they're adult women dealing with adult problems. And then lastly is one that I don't think gets talked about enough, and it's Koto Momuke. And this means directed at kids. And these are essentially just manga for kids. These tend to be short, episodic, teach good stories and good morals. Stuff like Doraemon is a big one. And obviously like Hello Kitty comics, which a lot of people might be familiar with here. And this might be something like the equivalent of kids reading Scooby-Doo or Looney Tunes or something like that.
So awesome. These, and you find that these demographics are kind of like, they're breaking down a little bit. They're a little bit fuzzier than they used to.
I think so. And especially with stuff like shoujo versus shonen, as far as like what's for young girls versus what's for young boys, I think we're starting to see a lot more kind of female protagonists pop up and male protagonists in shoujo manga, where it's like we're getting a lot of demographics sort of crossing. And as far as, you know, you have like shonen, which is for young boys, and you have seinen, which is a little bit more adult, I'm finding that those lines are getting a little more blurred too, which is very tough, because as far as like when a parent comes in looking for a manga, sometimes they're picking up something that, as far as American standards, is probably just not appropriate for right. their kids.
What's really interesting about all these demographics is that they, like, literally we just like covered all types of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, you know, in very broad and silly sure. in silly terms, like yeah. pretty much everyone is technically encompassed in those.
Yeah.
And that speaks to like what a huge audience manga has
absolutely.
In Japan.
Yeah.
You looked into this a little bit, Curtis.
I did. We're going to talk a little bit about kind of sales numbers in Japan, which blew me away. I knew it was huge.
Mm-hmm.
And you always... We hear this a lot in the comic shop, that everyone in Japan reads comics, and it's true. You know, some quick bullet points for sales numbers. 27% of all book sales in the year of 2008 in Japan were manga.
My goodness.
That is intense to think yeah. about. 30% of all book sales were comic books. One Piece, which is the most popular manga in the world, sold 14 million copies in Japan alone mm-hmm. in the year of 2015.
So what could you compare that to? What's an equivalent book in the U.S.?
So last year, the biggest selling comic book in America was Marvel Disney's Star Wars number one,
mm-hmm.
and it sold 1 million copies.
Yeah. Wow.
Which is about four times its nearest rival.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that is a huge example. Normally, yeah, a big selling book in America is 250,000 copies. One Piece is the best-selling manga for 9 years in a row. It's sold 380 million volumes in total, you guys.
Yeah.
That's a staggering number. Last year alone, there were 10 books that sold over 6 million copies, which is just blowing my mind. Manga sales in North America had been growing for years, but crashed hard in the year 2006. But print media in general is on the rise across the board, books, comics, everything.
Sure.
And since 2006, manga's had year-on-year gains. Last year, sales were up 15%.
That's crazy.
In the U.S.
Maybe a little bit of that is Attack on Titan. We don't even have time to go into it. But
yeah, in America, definitely Naruto and Attack on Titan are cited as being big
for the U.S. market.
Correct. Sure. Yep.
Cool.
I feel like we got to touch on this idea about the comic buying of children in Japan versus America. I find it to just be incredibly fascinating. And I think it's a huge cultural difference that leads to some of these book sale numbers in Japan.
Yeah. And this goes back to kind of a lot of this post-war Japan stuff that we've been talking about and how dramatically that affected all of this stuff. You know, there was a big economic boom as Japan's being rebuilt after this massive infrastructure destruction. And kids had money in post-war Japan, and they were buying comic books with that money. And they were going to places that sold comic books and buying it themselves for themselves, which is really cool. I never thought about this. So not only did kids in post-war Japan get into the habit of reading comics, but they got into the habit of buying comics. And as they grew up, the comics grew with them, and there were comics to meet them at every age. And they just had this whole kind of habit of going to the store and buying their own book. But in America, it was totally different. Parents typically bought their kids their comics.
Sure.
So there wasn't this kind of ritual of the child going and getting their books. I think it's incredibly interesting. It's just, you know, you go grocery shopping, you create these habits throughout your life. And in Japan, comics is one of those habits.
Yeah, and that'll follow you
as
for
you
life,
go. Yeah,
right?
And the cool thing with manga is there was books there to meet you know, as you grew. So it was both those things together. So very cool.
So we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about piracy and digital, the digital problem that manga is facing right now.
Absolutely.
So this is not lost on anybody. The whole industry is suffering as a result of digital piracy for manga. We see it in the United States. A lot, you know, it's a significant problem here.
Yes.
But they're not missing it in Japan either.
Not at all. In the year 2014, the Japanese government passed a new anti-piracy law. It's a huge operation that targeted specifically almost 600 illegal operating scanlation sites. Scanlation is a word for people who scan manga and then illegally distribute it on the internet. The Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry estimates $20 billion a year are lost through piracy.
It's just an insane number.
Yeah.
So the manga magazines, this is like the traditional bread and butter of manga. The sales peaked in 1995, and they've been falling ever since.
Correct.
And manga sales, what do we have here? Manga sales in general, this is probably volumes.
Correct.
Of manga sales dropped 43% since 2007.
Correct. And a huge amount of that is attributed directly to piracy. A lot of books are day and date scanned and available for folks to steal on the internet, which is pretty nuts.
So a lot of this that we're talking about is like the U.S. market and the effect on the U.S. market, because this stuff has to get translated, and that process can take a really long time when it goes through traditional channels where you can pay money for it. But these scanlators, as they're called, they're scanning books, they're wiping out the letters, they're translating them, and then someone's going in and lettering them.
Correct. Right? Yeah, and you know the effect that I think a lot of people don't realize is American companies license product for sale in this country, and if they cannot see a return on their investment, they stop licensing stuff.
Yes.
They stop licensing stuff. These Japanese companies that produce manga, these artists, they get less money. They produce less manga in their own country. There's less stuff, too. So it's this downward spiral of...
Yep.
In our comic store, the single hardest hit thing by piracy that we've seen in our 20 years of being a comic store is definitely manga.
Oh, 100%. And a lot of direct market shops don't carry manga.
Absolutely.
Especially the way, you know, we carry a lot of it, but it's tougher to come by. So for a long time, Borders was the go-to place for manga.
Yes.
Borders bookstore, right? They estimated somewhere between a third and a fifth of all manga market dollar sales in the United States. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. As someone who used to work at Borders myself, manga was always a huge problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
Borders had a policy where, like, if someone was reading a book, you were not really to disturb them. They were having a moment, and Borders wanted them to have that connection there. And then we would get kids dropped off at Borders for like hours at a time, and they would just sit in the manga section and plow through a whole series.
Yeah.
And that was their idea, and they would buy a cup of coffee or something like that. But the unlike any other section of the store that I worked in, manga was the one where people would just come, read, and leave.
And that's always what you hear, and that's always the sense that I got anytime I was in a Borders. And exactly. Yet, for all of that,
yep.
Between a third and a fifth of all sales are still coming out of directly from Borders bookstores, even in spite of that. That just lets you know how huge that one bookstore was for manga.
Yeah, people were freaking out when Borders closed because of that stat right there.
Yeah. Oh, if you're a publisher of manga,
it's huge.
And Borders is closing, you're sweating bullets.
And then when that happened, you know, publishers over the last nine years have been dropping like flies. And it's not all because of Borders. It's because of this digital thing. And it's because of, you know, just changes in the market in general.
And there's definitely been a rebound.
And there's been a little bit of a rebound. Mm-hmm. But the fact that fans of manga are overwhelmingly young, and that has hurt the industry because the industry has not organized and come up with a comprehensive plan for digital distribution.
True.
And young readers are plugged into digital distribution. And if there's an easy way to get it legally and pay for it, they'll do that, but there has not been an approach that like accounts for how new people are actually reading right now.
Right.
Which is kind of a bummer. So everything gets left to these scanlators, and the industry is universally agreed that it's bad. There's all these organizations that like try to combat it, but there's nobody has like they haven't teamed up and made an iTunes for manga.
Right.
So there is some hope. There's a lot of self-digital publishing by creators. They're putting out their own stuff, and they're doing their own translations and editing. The Digital Manga Guild invites fan translators and letterers, and they localize titles for different markets, and then they do a profit-sharing thing.
I love that
and this
idea.
And this is legitimate, and they share their profits with creators. So digitization is empowering creators right now, just like it is in a lot of different industries, but the question is that will the industry survive long enough to adapt, or will they? Because right now they're just trying to hit this aging readership that is, you know, obviously aging and is not where the money is.
Sure.
So without new young readers, the industry is not sustainable, not at the numbers that it's doing right now.
Sure.
So we're in the middle of this like really crazy. People don't read those manga magazines that we talked about. It's just they're just cratering, and that nobody reads manga like that in the same numbers that they used to. So the industry is having a shift right now. We're right in the middle of it.
Yep.
And it's definitely worth noting, too, that it also affects the anime industry as
yes.
well. I mean, it's just like you see in manga, it's a huge problem with piracy. And you're seeing, just like publishers, you're seeing entire animation studios just going down and completely shutting down.
Yeah.
Because they cannot keep up.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to watch. And it's been cool to see this little bit of a rebound that we've been happening, that we've been seeing, rather.
Yeah, and I think print media in general, a little bit of a leveling off with the digital thing, you know, is across the board. Digital reading has kind of peaked at around a quarter of the market. So, you know, there's some interesting things afoot.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is yes, there needs to be a digital solution for manga.
Mm-hmm.
And anime fans, you know, need to really respect these creators and understand that reading a free manga sounds really great. But just going through all this stuff, looking at the ripple effect.
Yeah, there's a direct cost.
Absolutely.
Yep.
It's intense.
The whole industry's feeling it.
So if you love manga and anime,
yep,
somebody's got to get paid.
So this is the drop in the bucket of what we could have talked about for manga. Like, there's so much more we could have done.
Maybe we do a whole thing on Tokyo Pop, too.
We didn't talk about creators, really, at all, and that deserves its own thing, because the voices are as diverse as any medium of entertainment, and that deserves probably some more attention at some point.
Yeah.
We're just going to have to bring Charlie back.
Charlie, I'm always here.
You cool with that?
Oh, so cool.
Thanks for hanging out with us and being on Super Skull today.
Yeah, thanks for being my buds today.
We're bud every day.
Aww.
Believe. That's going to do it for us today. Our producer and editor is Rachel Polk. Special thanks to Matt for audio technical support today. Matt's awesome. Our music was created by A-Bomb. All of our art and design was created by Philip Wong. And a very special thanks to the Ann Arbor District Library for the use of their recording studio.
Please subscribe, download, and review Super Skull on iTunes, if you would please.
We have a ton of things on the internet. We'd love if you checked us out on all of them. just got to type in Super Skull Show. That is our handle and our website.
Super Skull is brought to you by Vault of Midnight, Earth's finest comic books and stuff since 1996, and podcasts. Don't forget about those. My name is Nick Weibar.
I'm Marcus Schwimmer.
I'm Thunderlip Sullivan.
Oh, I'm Charlie Tucker.
And we wish you good reading until next week.
Best part of waking up is a little Curtis in my cup.
Ooh.
Means you spunk into my cup.
Oh,
in
I
the
thought
morning.
I Jesus. Meant like a, just I just dipped a nut in it. Did I tell you guys about my prison dream?
What is it?
I just had a bunch of tattoos around my eyes, and I was like at a, I was at like just one eye, and yeah. Then I had a bunch of tats, and I was at a table, and I was going in. I was getting processed. I was going in the prison, but for some reason, some other prisoner was getting out. And I knew this guy, and he was going to, like, do some stuff when he's on the outside. So I, like, grabbed him by the head, and I twisted his head, and I got right up, and I was, like, talking into his eyeball. And I was like, man, when you get out of prison, when I get out of prison, I'm going to find you, and I'm going to do stuff to you that's bad.
Okay.
And that was the
then
I woke up.
Then what happened?
Then I just woke up.
Wait, you said it to that guy?
To that guy. I was going in the joint, so I had this intense feeling like, fuck, I got to get out of here. This guy's going to do stuff. And I had weird
Shit.
Eye tattoos.
Did you have a neck? I know you love neck tattoos. Did the eye tattoo shift down to the neck?
I don't remember having a neck tat.
I still don't believe that Curtis likes neck tattoos.
But for some reason, I was talking into his eye, you guys. Like, I had his head, my hands on, like, his chin and his forehead.
Yeah, I know that's not true.
I was, like, talking into his eyeball.
When we were playing The Division, my neck tattoo was the first thing Curtis commented. He was like, oh, nice neck tattoo.
I love neck tats.
He doesn't really.
I do.